Hello, and welcome to the January 2022 IASB Update Podcast. My name is Neely Shaw, and I am the Executive Technical Director at the IASB. Today, I am joined by Andreas Barco, the Chair of the IASB, and Sue Lloyd, the Vice Chair. And we'll be talking about some topics discussed at the IASB's meeting on the 25th of January, as well as some other recent developments since our December IASB podcast. So at this week's meeting, we had three main areas that we covered. The first is administrative and strategic matters. The second is some feedback on recent consultations. And the third is further deliberations on our primary financial statements project. Let's start with administrative and strategic matters. The first thing that the board talked about was an update on the status of the IASB's work plan. At a high level, the board is progressing as planned, and there are three main takeaways. The first is that we do not expect any further consultation documents to be issued in the next 6 months. And the only reason I mention that is that we know that the last couple of years, we've had a heavy load of consultation documents published, and we really appreciate all of the feedback that our stakeholders have provided, but there is a break in sight. The second topic that we covered in the IASB work plan update related to goodwill. This is a really big project with some very important decisions to be made. And even though the last time the staff discussed the topic with board members was in November, we are working away in the background and do expect to come back to the IASB in the coming months. And then the final update that we provided the board related to the management commentary project. Many of you will recall that the comment period on the exposure draft ended in November. And one of the key themes from the comment letters was that the IASB should consider the implications of the newly formed International Sustainability Standards Board on the management commentary project. So the staff will be coming back to the board in March and April to discuss the full picture of feedback on the project, and then subsequently discuss with the board next steps in light of this key theme. We also covered, as I mentioned, some strategic matters, focusing on the prioritization of projects arising from post-implementation reviews. Andreas, can I turn things over to you to tell us a little bit more about PIRs, why the IASB discussed prioritization, and the outcome of that discussion?
With pleasure, Neely, and hello to everyone. Just as a reminder, the IASB is asked by our due process handbook to conduct a post-implementation review for any major new standard or major amendment to a standard approximately 3 years after the standard has become effective. So PIRs are a very important tool for the IASB to assess whether new IFRS accounting standards or major amendments to IFRS accounting standards are operating as intended. After sales management, you could label that. A PIR may give rise to findings that require additional work, but both we and our stakeholders have limited capacity. So we need a consistent approach to prioritize work coming out of PIRs in relation to all of the other IASB's other activities. The IASB decided on considerations for whether to do further work on matters identified in a PIR and when to do that work, ranging from immediately to considering in the next agenda consultation, probably only in 5 years, depending on how significant the matter is. In the discussion, some IASB members noted confusion about PIRs that needs to be clarified. For example, application questions can be raised with the IASB or the Interpretations Committee at any time. Stakeholders do not need to wait for a PIR. In fact, in recent years, the IASB has placed more emphasis on supporting the implementation of new accounting standards and has established transition resource groups to help. One big area of the discussion at the board table were about how we should handle the application issues, and I think we still need some further thinking about this. The outcome of PIRs could range from do nothing to educational materials to referrals to the Interpretations Committee to narrow scope amendments or to major standard setting. So there's really an array of different possibilities. The PIRs seek to explore new information and not to rehash old debates where there is now no new information. And this is a very important issue because change is disruptive. And we want to avoid flip-flopping on technical decisions every time we have new board members at the table or new people opining on something. So I hope that provides a bit of clarity. Nili, back to you.
Thank you, Andreas. So that was the first part of our January IASB meeting. The second part of the meeting covered feedback on three of the IASB's recent consultations. Let's start off with the lack of exchangeability project. As many are aware, IAS 21 requires companies to use a spot exchange rate when reporting foreign currency transactions. However, guidance is needed in the event that that spot exchange rate between two currencies does not exist. To deal with this issue, the IASB published an exposure draft in April 2021. And that exposure draft proposed to add requirements to IAS 21 to help companies determine when there is a lack of an exchange rate between two currencies and the requirements to apply when there is that lack of an exchange rate. Sue, can you give us some highlights from the feedback that we received on this project and that was discussed this week?
Sure, Neely. So this set of proposals that was in the exposure draft really followed on from an agenda decision that the Interpretations Committee issued a few years ago, which emphasized that in order for an exchange rate to be considered a spot exchange rate for the purposes of IAS 21, that exchange rate needs to be actually available for access, if you like, by entities. And that led to the inevitable question of, well, okay, if the official quoted rate isn't a spot rate as defined in IAS 21, then, you know, what rate should you use? And that's what these proposals are all about. Question that's interesting to a lot of people, and you can tell that because we received nearly 50 comment letters about that. And at this meeting, the board was getting an overview of the main feedback that we got in the feedback to the exposure draft. And many respondents basically agreed with the proposed definition of what exchangeable means. So, you know, when you have a lack of exchangeability and when you don't. Most respondents also agreed that where there isn't a spot exchange rate, just referring to the quoted exchange rate, for example, that an entity should be required to estimate the rate that they should use in those circumstances. They also, many respondents also agreed with the requirement, or the proposed requirement, that an entity disclose how a lack of exchangeability between two currencies affects the entity or is expected to affect the entity. And it's not just about the exchange rate per se, but how it affects its financial performance, its financial position, and its cash flows. Because if you're in that sort of environment, there's bigger business consequences that need to be explained. And we also got a lot of good comments and questions on aspects of the proposals, as well as the general agreement that I was just describing there. So, for example, there were questions about what the concept of a normal administrative delay is, in the words that we used, and also some requests for more clarity on the role that rates can play if they're not considered to be spot rates. So, for example, if there is an official rate in a market, but it's really difficult to actually get currency using that rate, then what role can that rate play in the estimation process? So we talked at the meeting about some of these comments, and the board gave the staff some suggestions on areas where we might want to do further digging and research to determine on how to respond to that feedback.
Thank you, Sue. So as next steps in the coming months, the staff has some homework to do. And then our expectation is that we'll come back to the board for further deliberations and decisions on what the next steps for the project might be. At the January meeting, the IASB also discussed another consultation document that was the proposed taxonomy update for the amendments to IFRS 17 on the initial application of IFRS 17 and IFRS 9 on comparative information. We did receive a small number of comment letters, which were supportive of this proposal, so our expectation is that we will finalize the taxonomy updates in March. And then the final project that we discussed feedback on is our business combinations under common control project. And just to step back for a few minutes to provide a little bit of context and remind everyone about this project, what the IASB is looking to do here is consider the accounting in a subsidiary's standalone financial statements for the transfer of a business from a sister subsidiary. So said a different way, if you imagine a parent has subsidiary A and subsidiary B, which are both under common control, and subsidiary B transfers a business to subsidiary A, the question is, in subsidiary A's standalone financial statements, how do you account for that transfer of a business? Do you follow IFRS 3 and use the acquisition method? Do you use some sort of predecessor basis of accounting or something else? Today, there's diversity in practice, and the board is looking to try to alleviate some of that diversity through this project. Now, the comment period on this discussion paper ended in September 2021. The IASB started exploring feedback in December and finished that discussion in January. Sue, can you provide us with some highlights on the feedback that was discussed?
Sure. So just to recap quickly, we received over 100 comment letters on this set of proposals, and also we had nearly 80 meetings with respondents across different regions and stakeholder groups. So we've got a really rich set of information to work with, which is great. And just to build on a little bit what Nelly was saying there, in the proposals, the board had suggested that it would be appropriate for there to be two different ways that you might account for these types of acquisitions when you're looking at the entity who's made this acquisition's financial statements. And depending on the facts and circumstances, the accounting that would apply would either be very similar to what we have in IFRS 3, so sort of acquisition accounting, where you look at the fair values of what you've acquired and calculate goodwill. And in other circumstances, you'd use what we call book value method, where you really take the sort of existing carrying amounts, if you like, and use those as the basis for the accounting going forward. And what we were looking at this month was really some of the feedback on the specifics of those different methods and the proposals. So in summary, most respondents agreed that when an entity applies the acquisition method to one of these types of transactions, that applying the approach in IFRS 3, as is proposed in the proposals, is essentially something they support. And they agreed that when they apply the method, that goodwill should be recognised if the fair value of what's the consideration that's paid for the acquisition exceeds the fair value of the identifiable net assets. And also there was general agreement that rather than recognising a gain in profit or loss, if the fair value of the net assets received exceeds the fair value of the consideration paid, that for these types of transactions, a contribution to equity should be recognised. So that was generally supported. Respondents also generally agreed with the preliminary views that when you apply a book value method, that the proposals about how to measure the consideration paid, for the fact that there should be an amount recognised in equity for any difference between the consideration paid and the book value of the assets and the liabilities received, and that the transaction costs incurred should be recognised as an expense in the period. And also there was general agreement with the preliminary views that the disclosure requirements that should apply for the acquisition method and the book value method should be consistent with what was set out in the proposals. So that was good, agreement on those. But there were more split views on some other aspects. And in particular, respondents were split on when applying the book value method for a business combination under common control, how the receiving entity should measure the assets and the liabilities received. So many respondents agreed with what was proposed, which was that the assets and liabilities should be measured based on the book values in the transferred entity's financial statements. But others disagreed and suggested that another group entity's book values should be used. And in particular, some, I think, would think that the previous parent, if you like, their book values were the ones that should be used in the transfer. There were also split views on the proposals about the restatement of comparative information. In the proposals, it's proposed that, like a sort of normal acquisition, that there shouldn't be a restatement of pre-combination information because the receiving entity wasn't in control of the entity they acquire in the previous periods. And there should rather be disclosure in the notes to provide that information. But many respondents said that they actually think that restating the pre-combination information would be costly and outweigh the benefits. But others said that actually that's already required in many jurisdictions and that information is really helpful for trend analysis. So split views there. So next, the board will talk about the project scope at a future meeting and also how the measurement method should be selected. So for those of you interested in business combinations under common control, more decisions to come in the next future board meetings.
Thank you, Sue. The board has quite a few difficult decisions ahead of it, so lots to look forward to. So the final component of our January meeting was some substantive redeliberations on our primary financial statements project. This month, the ISB focused on management performance measures. And as a reminder, just to take a step back, the primary financial statements project is one aspect, focusing on providing structure and discipline on the statement of profit or loss by requiring and defining specified subtotals. At the same time, though, the project recognizes that management may wish to tell its own story beyond the specified subtotals, and sometimes may wish to do that using management performance measures, which are similar to what's more commonly called non-GAAP measures. And that those non-GAAP measures or management performance measures reflect management's views of performance. The board sees value in this discussion, but with this project seeks to improve transparency around the disclosures of those management performance measures. So in January, Andreas, the ISB had some tricky conversations ahead of it. What was the outcome of all of that?
Tricky indeed, Neely. So we first discussed comments relating to the proposals in the ED, why MPM communicates management's view of performance and reconciling those management performance measures and the most directly comparable subtotal or total, and whether it should actually be articulated as why or rather as how, so giving additional information. In the end, the board unanimously confirmed to require companies to disclose a description of why or how an MPM communicates management's view of performance, including how it is calculated and how it provides useful information. So that was almost a no-brainer. It also decided to require companies that the explanations of the MPM refer to the individual items reconciling the MPM to the nearest comparable subtotal, which is something that we have heard very strongly from users. And thirdly, to disclose a reconciliation between the management performance measure and the most directly comparable subtotal without requiring any particular format how this may be achieved. The majority of the board expressed a preference for having an illustrative example showing that the requirement could be met by providing a reconciliation table, but there was considerable debate about where to place that example, whether it should be as an illustrative example, as I said, or whether it should become really a requirement in the main body of the standard. We also decided to require companies to specify the amount in the statement of financial performance related to each line item in the reconciliation. We then turned to one of the thornier issues, being the breakdown of tax implications and NCI, so non-controlling interest, when doing the reconciliation. Views expressed in the comment letters and during the outreach were polarized in that users emphasized the need for that breakdown to be able to back out adjustments made by management if users did not agree with them in their own analysis, and preparers on the other side stating that doing so could be arbitrary and costly, particularly in situations where the reconciling items concern different legal entities in different tax regimes, such as an allocation could become really meaningless. In the end, we did not take a vote, but instead directed the staff to perform more outreach on how companies currently performing a reconciliation are approaching the relevant tax effects.
Thank you, Andreas. It's really a difficult question. And yes, the staff will be back with more information at a future board meeting. So that concludes all of the technical discussions from the ISB's meeting in January. But before we finish off this podcast, Sue, would you like to make an announcement about what we've shared today?
Make an announcement about an announcement. Yes, sure, Neely. So today, the trustees have announced that I'm going to be changing my role at the foundation, so becoming the vice chair of the new International Sustainability Standards Board, so helping set that up and working to develop this global baseline of information on sustainability for investors around the world, which is really exciting. I'm really looking forward to it. But I love the IASB as well and the Interpretations Committee, so it's sort of bittersweet in a way. And I'm really pleased, actually, that I have a new role, which is really exciting, but also I'm able to stay with the foundation and continue to work with all of the staff there, but also very closely with the IASB, you know, with the view to the connectivity that we've been talking about between the requirements set by the IASB and the ISSB. So really pleased to be taking on this new role.
So if I may just jump in here, Nili, if you allow me. Obviously, I'm very happy for you, Sue, that you were chosen by the trustees to take up that new role. And as you said, it's bittersweet, not only for you, but likewise bittersweet for us and for me personally, because two of us have worked together very well. You have done a lot for the organization, have been with the organization for more than a decade in various roles, have been absolutely instrumental for the board and on the staff, have been a fantastic vice chair over many, many years. And last but not least, you have chaired the Interpretations Committee. So you will certainly create a gap, and we hope to be able to refilling that gap rather sooner than later. Now, as you pointed out, you will not be away. You will still be within the foundation, and that is really the good news. So it's not a farewell, and I'm looking very much forward to continue working with you, albeit now in a slightly different capacity. You still have 4 or 5 weeks to go, and we will utilize that time to facilitate a smooth transition of your roles, the two important ones obviously being the Interpretations Committee chairman role and the other role being the vice chairship. We have started considerations on that, and we hope to be able to make announcements very soon, so stay tuned on that.
Thank you, Sue and Andreas. And Sue, on my personal behalf and on behalf of the staff, congratulations. We're excited for you, but also to warn you, don't think you've escaped us. We know where to find you when we want to chat about an ISB technical issue. And with that, that concludes our January update. You can catch up on previous episodes of this and the IFRS Interpretations Committee on our website, as well as our YouTube channel and Spotify. If you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. And remember to tune in next month for the February IASB update. Thank you, everyone.